Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Your life, your country. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham Podcast.
Welcome to the best of the Laura Ingraham Podcast. Thanks for listening. There's so many memorable guests and unforgettable moments from both radio over the years and this podcast. And I thought it'd be a great time during this vacation period to put some of this together so you have it at your fingertips. Conversations with my most incredibly scintillating guests, hilarious moments, all unforgettable. Enjoy it here on the Laura Ingraham Podcast.
There's an intolerance that's being spread in this country, in this world, and it comes from the political dialogue. Let's be clear, it comes from political leaders.
We need to be mindful in our own rhetoric and in our own actions, how we're pushing it.
The language he uses in this manifesto is all about invaders. It's also language that President Trump used in a campaign ad before the midterm election.
Yeah. The shooter specifically invoked our president as an inspiration.
President Trump, whether intentionally or I think in a lot of cases even inadvertently, has provided a lot of fodder for people like this.
Well, this was the lowest of the low. So after this New Zealand massacre, where he got this whack job and he writes a manifesto that was designed to divide people, designed to send people down this, you know, rat hole of recriminations and blame shifting and so forth, the media just laps it all up. Of course, there's no coverage of the 12 churches burned in Europe, and the relentless attacks on Muslims, Jews, and Christians by Islamists that have been going on now for decades, especially in the last 10 years or so. It's the height of cruelty toward others who disagree with the Islamists. We could do entire shows every day just on that topic. But nevertheless, the power of words. And Trump represents, I think, to the left, this old style, kind of no holds barred, masculine, I'm going to dominate the room. I'm going to take the field. America's going to win. We love winning. We're the biggest, the best. They don't like that. It makes them very uncomfortable when the United States is on top. They like it when America is bowing down or apologizing or just part of the great global community as Obama and Biden, love to be. That's why the Europeans are all telling Biden that he has to run, because they don't like this whole populist movement cropping up all over Europe, because it disempowers the elites. So the power of language and the idea of masculinity really is interwoven into this current debate about and even beyond, way beyond Trump and where Trump is. And someone has written so persuasively about all of these types of issues beyond politics into the culture is Jordan Peterson. Of course, his book 12 Rules for Life, the paperback, just coming out, and it was a massive worldwide bestseller. He joins us now to talk about how they're even taking his book out of bookstores in New Zealand because the power of ideas, too powerful to in the wrong hands, or they're toxic themselves, so they have to be removed from the public square, which just diminishes our ability to think and have free debate. He joins us now. Jordan, how are you? Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, too. Thank you for the invitation.
Jordan, let's talk about this socio-political landscape that has developed around us, about language and ideas and how the left, especially, every time there's a tragedy that they can pin on others, more traditional thinkers, they rush in to do that rather than have a debate about the underlying issue.
Well, people want to come up with a solution that's in accordance with what they already believe, because that's cognitively the most straightforward thing to do. I mean, it's the proclivity of people everywhere to use their already formulated ideas whenever they have the opportunity to do so. And then you also pointed out in the intro that the person who perpetrated the massacre in New Zealand had written a manifesto that was specifically aimed at increasing division and this positive feedback loop partisanship that we see emerging in the media and on social media.
Well, what part of this, your book is dangerous to their worldview? What specifically about 12 rules for life? That they're pretty basic rules, like make your bed and there's some basic things that were traditional things. They were basic to all of us growing up.
Well, they were designed that way. I mean, when I wrote the rules, I knew perfectly well that they were, in some sense, you might consider them self-evident maxims. And so, of course, that raises the question of why they need to be written about or defended. But I would say in a chaotic time, it's necessary for people to begin to understand consciously what they've always abided by unconsciously. Otherwise, everyone ends up far too confused. I think the fundamental threat that my work poses to the radicals on the left, but also the identitarian types on the right, is that I'm writing about the centrality of the individual, especially in relationship to responsibility rather than rights, let's say, and that I insist on the utility, necessity, inevitability, and functionality of hierarchies, even at the basic level of perception, because it is the case, and I outline this, for example, in chapter 10, which is called Be Precise in Your Speech. You can't look at the world without viewing it through a hierarchy, because you have to organize what's important before you can perceive what's necessary. And so the radical left is very much threatened by the emphasis that I'm placing on the individual as the primary unit of analysis, and by the insistence that I have that hierarchies are not only inevitable, but necessary, crucially necessary. And the breakdown of hierarchy, very, very dangerous thing.
Well, when you see young people, as you probably saw the video, Jordan, of that kid cracking the egg on the head of that right-wing politician in Australia who, I don't know, made some comment that got everyone upset after the Christchurch killing. The kid goes up, he's 17, cracks the egg on his head, and is cracking it on one hand, with one hand, videoing it with a cell phone on the other. The official smashes, cuffs him back, smacks him back, which is, think about this, what my father would have done. He would have backhanded me right in the car as we were driving. So he pushed him back, and then that kid becomes celebrated. He is celebrated globally. You showed him, and kids are speaking to adults in a manner in which I wouldn't have dreamed of speaking to adults. I mean, I still call my neighbors growing up in Connecticut, I still say, Mrs. Johnson and Mr. Kosmeski, and I would never, and they say, oh, call me by my first name. I said, you're 55 years old. No, I'm not going to call you by your first name. You're Mr. That's how we were raised. But now that's all out the window. Speaking of hierarchical problems.
Well, it's part of a continued assault on the idea of value itself, I would say, and on the idea that things have to be organized in terms of the primacy of their importance. I see it as I've explained this in some detail in my first book, Maps of Meaning, and in my lectures and in this latest book. I see it as a continuation of the destruction of the idea of order itself. I mean, even the mantra of the age, say diversity, inclusivity, equity, is profoundly anti-hierarchical. It couldn't be more anti-hierarchical. And the thing is that hierarchies aren't without their dangers. Anyone sensible understands that, because if a hierarchy is a structure of order, which is certainly one of the things that it is, it can become rigid and it can become dysfunctional in that it no longer performs the operations that it was designed to perform. you know, most of the time what happens, as far as I can tell, is that we as human beings have complex problems to solve because of our fragility. And we organize ourselves into cooperative and competitive hierarchies that are aimed at addressing those problems. That's how a functional society works. And then your position in the hierarchy is a function of your utility with regards to the solution of that particular problem. And it, I mean, that shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone in some sense. And every business is devoted towards solving a problem, providing a solution. Mm-hmm. You can argue about whether all the solutions are necessary, but that's a free market issue to some degree for that determination to be made. But there's no possibility of organizing ourselves properly and solving those complicated problems without hierarchy. And no one is educated anymore, I would say, to understand why that's not only useful but psychologically necessary for people. We can't survive sanely without order, because everything comes flooding in. That's the thing. When the walls crumble, everything comes flooding in. I would say psychologically, that's part of the reason that Trump's message was so attractive to people. The idea of the wall, you know, because, and the idea of the wall is a centrally conservative idea.
Yes.
In the classic sense. And what walls do is separate some things from other things so that everything doesn't blur into one overwhelming chaotic mass. And increasingly, people have the sense that that's what's happening. And so when Trump says something like, well, let's build a wall, it's very, very attractive to the part of the psyche that's overwhelmed by transformation and change that's too rapid.
Too fast.
And,
yeah.
And too much information as well. Information flow that's too, what would you say? It's transforming at a rate that no one can adapt to.
You know, and I think, you point out, and it's a very interesting way of looking at it. You point out that we moved for centuries or millennia as in packs. People moved in packs, family packs. There were multiple families moving together. And a hierarchy naturally develops through strength and skill. Certain people have skills in sewing. Others have skills in hunting. Others have brain power that can see enemies in the distance. That develops over long expanses of time, and it only became clear like why this was happening when we developed further as human beings. Like why did this all work? We never even thought about it, and then it became instinct for us to live this way. But today, with the rise of social media and the blurring of the lines between, I think, adults and children, which adults want to be infants their whole entire lives, they want to be infantilized, and children want to be adults. Like, it's a crazy dynamic we have now. Now we're having the push for, egalitarianism. It's all the, everyone's going to be equal. We're going to have an equal standard of living, equal salaries. It's going to be free college, free pre-K, free universal pre-K, free healthcare. Everyone's going to be equal. But then no one ever is really going to emerge equally at the same time. That never could happen. It hasn't happened through human history. But somehow they think it's going to work now.
Well, you know, the desire for a certain degree of equality is part of standard morality, let's say. You know, it's not like anyone, regardless of their political position, is pleased emotionally when they walk down the street and they see someone who's devastated and alcoholic and homeless. You know, it produces a pang in the soul of anyone with a conscience, and the attendant desire, at least from the perspective of compassion, to have a society organized so that such things don't occur. That's the emotional driver for that egalitarian vision. The problem is that egalitarian compassion alone is of insufficient sophistication to build a complex functional society. You need compassion and mercy, but you need justice and order as well. And those are of equal import, and they fight in some sense across mm-hmm. historical spans of time for predominance. You know, you want justice tempered with mercy, but by the same token, as we already discussed, without a hierarchy, you can't even perceive the world, and you can't organize yourself, to, especially in groups, to do anything of any utility. And the radical postmodernists in particular, in their strange association with the radical leftists, insist that every hierarchical structure is composed of nothing but the expression of raw power. And that's unbelievably pernicious because it destroys the idea of competence and authority.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with that, there's multiple problems with that. One is that, well, you're flooded, as I said before, by too much of everything. But you also have no goal anymore. You know, you said that children want to be adults, or at least they want to have the, let's say, the privileges of adults, and that adults want to be children. And I think that young people are having a hard time deciding that growing up is worthwhile, because if you destroy the idea of a hierarchy of order, you destroy the idea that maturity is possible and valuable, that functional maturity and competence itself is desirable. And so if the hierarchy is flattened and there's no up, there's no impetus for forward movement. And it's even worse than that, you know, psychologically speaking, because if there's no impetus towards forward movement, because nothing is more valuable than anything else, then there's no positive emotion, you see, because we're biologically constructed so that we experience a sense of engagement in the world when we see ourselves successfully pursuing a valued goal. And that assumes we have valued goals, and that assumes that we have a hierarchy.
Well, that's why nationalism, it properly understood, nationalism meaning love of country, not perverted nationalism to indicate oppression and subjugation, but nationalism meaning love of country, like what you love your nation. That's what, when real we love our nation, we want to work with other countries, but we love our country. Love of country subverted by individual groups that say, okay, standing for the national anthem, the Pledge of Allegiance, you're agreeing with the patriarchy. They do this to you, Jordan. When you go speak, as I saw that protester in Melbourne, and we're going to play this soundbite, they seek out individuals to brand them as part of the social unfairness that's pervasive because of this hierarchical structure that they want to destroy. Let's listen.
Push is always there to confront any far right or fascist presence. Now, Jordan Peterson is really just part of that far right that's there to pump out the misogyny and the homophobia and the racism and the transphobia
blah, blah, blah.
That we're very well aware of. But their whole purpose in coming on these tours of Australia is to build a global far-right movement. So this is why we have to be there every time.
So, Jordan, you're working on building that global... You sound pretty mild-mannered to me. I don't know. You said building that global far-right movement of this crazy idea of individual liberty and freedom and free thought and free expression. It's very dangerous.
Well, it's mostly, and this is the crucial issue, and I think this is what separates my thinking in some sense and what I'm doing from whatever might be comparable or conceivably comparable, is that the individuality that I'm stressing is conceptual first. So the idea is that the primary lens through which another should be viewed is the lens of individuality. And the second element is that I'm speaking primarily about individual responsibility, not individual rights. And so this isn't it has nothing to do with the right wing in a political sense. It has nothing to do with the left wing in a political sense either, because it's not a political idea. The idea is that it's a psychological idea, and the idea is that your best bet with regards to contending with the tragedy of the world without becoming bitter and hurt and vengeful is to adopt a responsible stance towards being and to tell the truth and to act courageously and to extend that responsibility to your family and your community. You know, and nationalism, the nationalism that you referred to in its positive aspect, is the extension of that responsibility to the community.
To each other.
It's also predicated on the idea that your community can't be infinitely large in scope. And that's the Tower of Babel problem, I would say, fundamentally, is that, and this is exactly what's plaguing the European Economic Union, is that as the scale of the collective enterprise expands, the distance between the individual citizens and the people who are the elites, as you call them, grows necessarily. So it's a problem of hierarchy, perversely enough, even though it's something that's supported by the left. People feel that once their groups have gone beyond a certain size, that there's nothing about them that constitutes a collective project, and that they have no voice or influence in that process. And so they become alienated, and that's when fragmentation begins to occur. You can't be powerless. You can't be without influence in the group you identify with, because otherwise it's not your group. It's like you're not on the team. You're not playing the game. The game isn't even on anymore. And the people who are opposed to national borders, let's say, don't understand that the demolition of the local will produce much larger, much
chaos,
more rigid, and much less responsive hierarchies.
I want to play something for you, Jordan, about, and this cuts right into what you're talking about with how people are trying to find their own identity or group that they can have influence in, and I think it also addresses this issue of the perpetual. We're all infants. I mean, no one wants to stand up and take personal responsibility for his or her actions or life when it's much easier to blame some other collective or other individual for your problems. Some people blame mommy and daddy, spend their whole life talking about mommy and daddy did this to me and my mommy and daddy did. Okay. All right. Now what are you going to do? All right. And then there's another issue, and that's that issue of privilege that Ocasio-Cortez talks about. Let's listen.
Almost every single person in this country can acknowledge some privilege of some type. You know, I'm a cisgendered woman. I will never know the trauma of feeling like I'm not born in the right body. Mm-hmm. And that is a privilege that I have, no matter how poor my family was when I was born. But it's really hard for some people to admit.
Well, she's basically saying that people are different. And so if you're different, then everybody has privilege. Take it away from the cisgender.
It's a dangerous and vacuous statement. And the reason that it's vacuous is the reason that you just pointed out, which is that we're all positioned in the world differently. And so we have a different range of, let's call them, opportunities and obstacles that confront us on a day-to-day and month-to-month basis. And so it's self-evident. But the dangerous part of that is, you see, this is one of the things I started to understand as I took apart what happened after the Russian Revolution and why it went so terribly wrong. You see, if you can identify dimensions of privilege, let's say that those would be associated with group identity, right? They frequently are. Dimensions of privilege. She talked about being cisgendered, for example, which, by the way, is a term I absolutely despise. But you can take apart everyone and you can find one dimension, and this is exactly what she says. You can find one dimension at least along which everyone has been unfairly advantaged by the past. for some reason. And then, so that's one thing. But the next thing is, then if you believe in radical equality of outcome as your goal, then all of that unfair privilege has to be eradicated. And what happens is that the privilege isn't eradicated. It's the people with the privilege that end up eradicated. And it's so dangerous because, I mean, it's so comical to hear Ocasio-Cortez point this out. She said, well, everyone has undeserved privilege. It's like, okay, well, if we're going to get rid of undeserved privilege, then what does that mean if everyone has it? And the proper response to that, as far as I'm concerned, is to be grateful for what you have and to bear your, what would you call it, to bear your inequalities with dignity, but to act responsibly as an individual agent. This is what the West figured out thousands of years ago, I would say, is that, of course, life is arbitrary and unfair. Obviously. There's nothing more obvious than that. So what do you do about that? And the answer is, well, you try to gratefully utilize your arbitrary talents in a manner that's beneficial, and you try to bear your unfair suffering with dignity and courage and not to become resentful and cruel because of it. That's your moral obligation. And I think I made a very strong case for that. I think I've been continually making a strong mm-hmm. case for that in my lectures and my books. And yeah. I don't see a more solid solution than that. It's okay to admit that it's unfair. I mean, obviously, what could be more obvious that the fact that there are these tremendous differences between people indicates a fundamental arbitrariness about the structure of being itself. And the question is, what do you do in the face of that? And the answer is, you bear your cross uphill. That's the answer.
You know who does this and speaks about this? And you maybe have met him, but if you haven't, I'm going to introduce you to him. My old boss, Clarence Thomas, in his book, My Grandfather's Journey, where this was like the whole book.
Uh-huh.
It was about, you know, he slept in a chair for the first, I think, 4 years of his life. He had no bed. And they had a pillow on a wooden chair. He had no, you know, his grandparents had to take him in because his mother had a lot of problems. And he was living in the South in Pinpoint, Georgia, dirt floor, dirt poor. And all the things he faced, all the things he went through, what his grandfather taught him, who was obviously lived in the segregated South, grew up there, dealt with all of this horrible discrimination. And he basically said, life lessons, Jordan, that were like this. And I say this to my kids, and they remember this. My son will say, I said, what's that in your hand? He said, that's my friend's lunchbox. I borrowed it from him. And then my other son, Dimitri, will say, don't ever take anything that's not yours from anybody, not even if it's a penny. Because that's what Justice Thomas's grandfather drilled into him as a young man, that, yeah, other people have more than you and always will, but don't you ever give away your power of your values and your morality and compromise your power. That compromises your own individual dignity and worth. Don't ever do that. And it stays with me.
Yes. Well, it compromises your integrity. And in this manner that has to be unpacked so that it's not a cliche.
Right.
It's like what you have to contend with the world is your integrity. And that's your honesty fundamentally mm-hmm. and your honesty and your courage.
Mm.
And it isn't like the people on the left are incorrect when they point to the injustice of inequality. It's that the solution is not only untenable, but will necessarily make things far worse.
And much more divisive.
All of the radical leftist experiments in the 20th century indicated quite clearly that, well, first of all, that inequality wasn't a function of capitalism, which is an absolute It's an absolute leftist delusion to presume that inequality is something so easily explained away. And their solutions that were imposed made inequality far worse than it had been in under the previous regimes. So, but it's not the, it's certainly not unreasonable to point out that inequality has this existentially painful quality.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, and I think, you know, that's where we can end this today is that, again, you can feel for, and everyone feels for individuals who, they didn't get a fair start in life. They didn't get a fair shake in life, and they've dealt with enormous physical, health, socioeconomic problems, and continue to. But the solution is, you know, let's give everybody an opportunity to better themselves in a society that is orderly, safe, with safety, and where we don't encourage more. I think division and resentment, which is what reparations. Next time we talk to you, Jordan, we're going to talk about the reparations push, which is growing in the United States.
Oh yes, I saw that. That's it's absolutely insane. It's absolutely Elizabeth Warren should be terminally ashamed of herself. It's an absolutely appalling idea, but it's a logical outgrowth of the notion of identity, group identity as the fundamental identity. So black versus white, let's say, with whites in this situation being the perpetrator. I don't know how this is going to work in practically. I mean, what if your white ancestors were fought for the North in the Civil War? Does that give you a discount on the reparations?
No, you get no discount.
Is this just a general guilt that's shared by all people who are white? And how exactly are you going to define that? That it's such a nightmare. It's just a miracle to me that a negative miracle to me that this can be, that this idea can be being discussed by people who have serious political pretensions.
Jordan,
it's
insane. You know what my view is? My view is Elizabeth Warren. She has a lot of self-interest. She has a conflict of interest in this because she thinks somehow the indigenous people, the Native Americans, will also get reparations so she can jump on that bandwagon. So she gets the 1/1,000th, 12th percent of all of this. Jordan Peterson, it's so great to talk to you. I can't wait to have you on the Ingram Angle when you're in New York. We'll work on that. And congratulations on all your success. You're a brainiac who's really you made brainiacs cool and thinking about all these extremely important issues, and so many young people have had their eyes opened by you. And just keep it up, and anything we can ever do for you, just let us know, okay?
Thank you. It's very nice talking with you.
A lot of people in the summertime, you know, feel like your skin is not what it could be. I mean, if you're like me, you put sunblock on, and that's really good. You should do that every day, no matter where you're going. Put on a good sunblock. That's just not on your face, but on your arms, anything where the sun is showing on. But also, as you get older, you get, you know, lines that, you know, you wish weren't there, especially along your jawline. And that's where my friends at Chamonix come in, because they have a great Genucel jawline cream, which I've used now for a couple of years. I've used the under eye for bags and puffiness longer, but the jawline treatment is a clean, incredibly natural, you know, effective product that you'll see the results from very quickly. And if you don't, because it has the Chamonix MDL technology, if you don't, then guess what? You get your 100% of your money back. Go to Genucel.com. That's just a great, great guarantee. And I promise you, you'll love it. So you text now. And the classic Genucel for bags and puffiness, that clear gel that you use under your eyes that I use, you get that for free just for trying the jawline cream. So it's very easy. All you do is text the word eyes, and the number 1 to 77453. Or go to Genucel.com. You can do it there too. And you're going to get 2 free gifts and free shipping when you order that jawline cream. Again, text EYES1 to 77453 or go to Genucel.com. This is the best of the Laura Ingram podcast. You're enjoying this. Oh, the Laura Ingram podcast. This is the best of. And thank you for listening. We love your feedback. Always love your opinions. Want to hear from you. So you can email the show at ingram.podcast@gmail.com. That's ingram.podcast@gmail.com. Email me with your thoughts, or if you want to get on the show, just email me the topic you want to talk about or react to the topic we're tweeting or Facebooking out. ingram.podcast@gmail.com. Keep the comments coming. All right, we're back on the Laura Ingram podcast. We're exposing the lies from the radical left, their attempt to co-opt the culture. Well, you might think the culture is lost, but no, it's not necessarily lost. It's only lost when you say it's lost and you give up. Their attempt to subvert the American family, the American tradition, our rule of law, our capitalist system, the free market, religious liberty. Never thought I'd be saying that, but you bet. Why? Because traditional Christian denominations, especially the Catholic Church, stands against their agenda. But when money's involved, it's very interesting how the concern about the kids, we're worried about the kids, their well-being, and the and women and in teens. We want them to be healthy and their authentic self, and we want them. It's funny how all that goes out the window when hundreds of billions of dollars is on the line in big weed, promoting pot, promoting the legalization of marijuana, promoting edibles, promoting even medical marijuana, when there are no peer-reviewed studies. To my mind, to my understanding, there are still no peer-reviewed studies definitively showing that marijuana has medicinal value. It's a big lie, a big way to crack that door open before it's flung open for all-out legalization. Okay, so that's what's going on. What is it? Is this all? This is just like alcohol. You know, so you hear all the arguments like prohibition, that didn't work. Well, what is this pot? What is this substance? What does it do to especially young and developing brains? We're learning a lot more about that. And joining us now is a brave guy, Alex Berenson. His book, Tell Your Children the Truth About Marijuana, Mental Illness, and Violence. He is rattling all the right cages with this. I love it. He joins us now. Alex, congrats on the book. It's fantastic.
Laura, thank you so much for having me on. And, you know, I'm not the brave one. The brave one are the people who get stuck with psychosis, which is a terrible illness, schizophrenia, after smoking. And the brave people are their families. And I've heard from so many mothers, especially mothers, whose sons, you know, and it's especially sons, have developed schizophrenia and really had their lives ruined after using. And you know, I've realized in the last couple of weeks that it's not Tell Your Children that's going to change this debate. It's these mothers, because the book tells the truth, and I'm passionate about the facts in the book, but my passion cannot compare to the passion of these parents who've seen their children's lives wrecked and whose own lives have been wrecked. You know, this psychosis, dealing with a child who's psychotic permanently, you know, it wrecks marriages, it wrecks families, it's devastating. Everything becomes about the disease, and it's really terrifying.
No.
And that's what's going to change the debate. Sure.
So I read the book, and I haven't seen the film, A Beautiful Boy, but it chronicles a family that has been just ripped apart by drug addiction, and that started in a little boy who was, I guess, 12 or 13, if my memory serves me correct. And it started with, you know, some drinking, but then it really, really started with marijuana. And all these people saying that marijuana is not a gateway drug. I mean, I just don't know many people who go right to heroin. They usually do start with marijuana. As far as everything that I read, everyone starts with marijuana, but it's somehow never a gateway drug.
No, there's zero question it's a gateway drug. The studies are incredibly clear on this. The only question is why it's a gateway drug. Is it a gateway drug because you start using and you start hanging out with people who are doing harder drugs, in which case, you know, that's actually an argument for legalization, believe it or not, because in that case you say, okay, we'll split it out. Or is it a gateway because pharmacologically it primes your brain for more addictive and pleasurable experiences? But what I do know is that encouraging people to use an addictive drug, especially if they're at high risk for addiction, is really stupid. And until the last 5 to 10 years, nobody ever said that marijuana was a cure for the United States opioid epidemic. And suddenly, because of a couple of really weak papers, the cannabis industry is promoting this point of view, and no one has noticed that the United States and Canada, which are the two countries that have the most cannabis use, also have by far the worst opioid epidemic. So it's like, if this stuff works as a, to get people off opioids, why is it that that's true?
That's, oh my gosh, it's really... Well, I have to say, when you listen to someone, I'll play this Chuck Schumer for you. This was last year, and he was talking about the legalization of marijuana in New York. Let's listen.
Where are you in recreational marijuana use?
My personal view is legalization is just fine.
So legalization is fine. I mean, that's a change for you.
Yeah.
That legalization is
Listen,
fine.
As I said, I looked at what's happened in the states that have done it. Seems to have worked out pretty well. All the parade of horribles that people talked about didn't occur. Crime did not spike in any place. There's no evidence that young people are using drugs of any type anymore. The pathway issue hasn't proven to be true. So it all makes sense.
Your reaction to that? I hadn't actually heard that before.
That's just factually incorrect. Cory Booker said something similar, and especially when you say violent crime, which Cory specifically said, he said violent crime was down in the states that had legalized. That's just untrue. Violent crime, by which I mean murders and aggravated assaults, the most serious violent crime, is up substantially more in the first four states to legalize since 2013 than in the United States as a whole. The data is undeniable. So violent crime is up. Suicides in which people had THC in their blood have increased fourfold in Colorado between 2006 and 2016. Driving deaths where people have been found to have THC in their blood are up. The idea that nothing bad has happened is just contradicted by the facts.
You know how Erin Brockovich he became a big cult hero on the left because she was exposing the the toxic chemical company and what it had done to poison people and cause cancer and so forth. They made the movie, and it was Brockovich. I mean, it's Susan Sarandon. Susan Sarandon, or was it? I think it was.
It was Julia Roberts.
Julia Roberts.
Julia Roberts.
That's right. So she became a cult figure. Like, I'm not trying to suck up to you here, but like, you're up against it here. You're out there, and there are a few others like you, who are standing against a multi-billion-dollar industry that has co-opted people like Schumer and people like John Boehner, who used to be against legalization until he got on the board of one of the big weed companies. And you're standing against somebody saying, no, this actually kills people.
Yeah.
And so you've received threats, I understand.
Well, I harassing vocals, threats on Twitter, I don't want to overstate it at this point, but let's just say that, I'm prepared for it to get worse. I don't care. The facts are what they are. And I've heard from too many people whose lives and whose family members' lives have been wrecked by this. And, I don't want to be an advocate. I'm a registered independent. Okay. I write spy novels. I've worked at the New York Times for 10 years as an investigative reporter, but I had a very good, profitable career writing spy novels in the last several years. I wrote this book because I felt I had to, because once I looked at the science, I couldn't believe how long the debate has been. And by the way, my wife is a forensic psychiatrist, and those are people who are basically responsible for cleaning up the wreckage here. So she sees the cases. She sees the terrible psychotic violence that this drug produces. And the psychiatrists know. They don't want to get involved. They don't want to discuss this because it's unpleasant, because they know that the advocacy community is going to scream at them. But the people who are running psych wards, the people who are evaluating these criminally mentally ill people, they all know the truth.
Well, Alex, I've been, I've read your stuff for many years, mostly the stuff in the New York Times. You're a really terrific writer. And most importantly, you're actually reporting. You're actually doing real reporting on an issue that has become, again, just commonly understood. And this is not a political issue. I take politics. It has nothing to do with politics. This is about science and about the experience of the THC use in individuals, especially hard hit our young people, and what it actually does to the population at large. That's what it's about. So it's not about politics. Somehow it became a political issue. It shouldn't be.
Well, because the advocacy community doesn't want to talk about the science. They'd rather talk about, you know, arrest rates. They'd rather talk about, you know, personal use. They'd rather talk about anything but the science here because the smarter people in the advocacy community know what the science says, and they know that this is a dangerous issue for them, so they don't want to talk about it. But the problem is not talking about it doesn't make it go away. And the impacts are real, and they're getting worse.
This is Sanjay Gupta, who's a very well-known physician, and he appears on CNN with Brian Stelter on the pot and opioids connection.
Cannabis can help treat pain. That is a consensus by the National Academy of Science. That is not an opinion. It can treat pain. It can treat the withdrawal when people are trying to come off of opioids. That is not an opinion, again. That is a fact. It can help heal an addict's brain so they don't continue to relapse. That's scientific data that's going on right now at Mount Sinai Hospital. The research is happening there. These are facts.
Are those facts?
Look, cannabis is an intoxicant, okay? Like alcohol, it's going to make you forget that you're in pain in the short term. And like benzos, it can soothe anxiety in the short term. By benzos, I mean Ativan, Valium, those prescription drugs that you get. That does not mean it's a good long-term pain reliever. There is a really good study from Australia that came out last year that shows that people over a four-year period who used cannabis and opioids reported higher levels of pain at the end of the period, and they reported more opioid use. Using an intoxicant to treat your pain doesn't work in the long run. There may be some people it benefits, okay, but on a population level basis, which is how we need to look at this stuff, if we're talking about public health, it doesn't work. It's just misguided.
What do you say when the usual comment is, well, you know, you can't, what are you going to, this doesn't work, so you're going to have to do prohibition, and alcohol is much worse for young people in the population, much worse than pot.
So alcohol is not much worse than pot. Alcohol is more physically toxic than pot. Pot is appears to be, and almost certainly is, more neurotoxic than alcohol. People don't get long-term psychotic disorders from alcohol unless they're really late-stage alcoholics. Alcohol doesn't seem to impact the developing brain as severely as pot does. All these parents, you know, in places like Brooklyn who think, oh, it's okay if my 16-year-old smokes pot, it's much better than drinking, they are just completely wrong. They should be discouraging their kids from doing both, but the idea that cannabis is somehow better than alcohol is nuts. The reason the book is called Tell Your Children is in part because I knew the blowback I was going to get, because that was actually the original title of the movie Reefer Madness, but it's in part called Tell Your Children because I want parents to have the information they need to talk to their children about this. And I want even young adults who are using, who may have noticed problems in their own use, they can't cut back, they're having more paranoid thoughts, I want them to understand the context of this and that they are really at risk for a dangerous mental illness.
All right, on the line we have Sam in Maryland, who's the parent of a 16-year-old. Sam.
Hey, Laura, how are you?
I'm great, thanks.
Hey, by the way, thank you for all you do.
I appreciate that.
You're
thank
a great
you.
Voice for the unspoken, and we really, really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
You know, my experience, I'm about your age, late 50s. I grew up middle school, high school in the Valley in California back in the mid-70s. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the use of marijuana was very prevalent amongst my peers. And I saw it destroy a lot of young, smart, talented people who used it as a gateway to get into harder things. And these were bright young kids whose lives were just destroyed. A couple of them ended up dead. I know one or two of them in jail, and just too many of them who just got derailed from productive lives. And I'm just a firm believer that it is a gateway. Unless you're really taught to make good decisions and understand, you know, don't let it affect your life.
Well, I think that's well said. I mean, Nick Sheff, who's the subject of that New York Times, writer, and his story about his son. Nick was his son, is an incredibly smart young man. What's scary is what you get into that cycle. We're talking to Alex Berenson from the New York Times, his new book, which is a stunner, Tell Your Children, Truth About Marijuana, Mental Illness, and Violence. He's a New York Times bestselling author, number one New York Times bestselling author. And it's a must read. But what's really scary is that once you get into the drug culture, it gets worse. It gets, and then the highs don't, they don't deliver, especially when the young brain, because the young brain's always looking for the next thing, next thing, next thing, next thing. You get to the next thing, and then suddenly you find yourself shooting up. And then you're shooting up, and you're in rehab 4, 5, 6, 7 times. And once you're into some of these drugs, the ability to recover, you're in recovery, but to really kick the habit it's like 10%. Alex, you can close it out on that thought.
Sure. I mean, I think cannabis definitely can lead to harder drug use. But all by itself, it's a danger.
All by itself, it's bad.
All by itself, it's bad. And I'll tell you that the only thing, and I haven't talked to these family members, these mothers, the only thing that is worse than being the mother of a heroin addict and waiting for the call that your son has overdosed is to be the mother of somebody with schizophrenia who's living on the street, who's making violent threats, and waiting for the call that he's either killed himself or possibly killed someone else. And some of these family members tell me that is actually the call they are waiting for now, because they know, you know, after somebody's been hospitalized 17 times, he's not getting better. It's just a question of how much damage he does over the rest of his life. And that is a terrible, terrible thing, and we need to talk about it.
Alex Berenson, a must-read book that the marijuana industry does not want you to read. Tell Your Children the Truth About Marijuana, Mental Illness, and Violence. It's our featured selection today, and you have to get this book. We're going to have him on television. I'm going to be covering this a lot in the coming year, because there's going to be increasing pressure, financial pressure and otherwise, on states, more states, to legalize marijuana. It's a multi-billion-dollar lobbying push across the country. And there's just enormous amount of money on the line. Whenever money's involved, oftentimes the best interests of the people, especially our young people, are not going to be put at the forefront. Alex, congrats on the book. We'll see you on TV. America, now and forever, you're listening to the best of the Laura Ingraham podcast. Tom Cotton, who is just one of the most dedicated patriots of in the U.S. Senate. He is a man of he's a humble man, given his accomplishments. A phenomenal lawyer, served his country with honor and integrity in uniform. He has a fabulous new book called Sacred Duty, A Soldier's Tour at Arlington National Cemetery. And I thought of Senator Cotton because I actually was at Arlington on Memorial Day with my kids. And we spent quite a bit of time there, and it was very hot. And we went to the Arlington ceremony when Vice President Pence came and laid the wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, and then spoke with the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the Acting Secretary of Defense. And just that whole day was very special to my family. And his book, I mean, it's just I had a chance to read most of his book before I actually went to Arlington that day. Been there many times. But it made it all come to life, and I'm just so happy he's with us. Such a historic week for the country, for our allies, for Europe, and for all free people. He joins us now. Senator Tom Cotton, congrats on the book, my friend.
Hey, Laura. Thanks for having me on, and thanks for your interest in Sacred Duty. It's a very special day, the 75th anniversary of D-Day, and I'm glad to hear that you were able to go to Arlington with the family. It's a special place for our families as well, and teaching the next generation of Americans the kind of sacrifices that their ancestors have made so they could live in peace and freedom.
Of course, Senator, when you walk through Arlington, it's almost in a way too much to take. I mean, it's too much to take in for a young person. They can't really process what this is. None of us can, really, because every time we walk by a grave, I mean, and you stop and you pause, you think this was a father or a son or a wife or a nurse or a child. And I didn't realize that so many children were actually buried in Arlington Cemetery, children of the fallen.
Yes, unfortunately, especially in the older sections of the cemetery when infant mortality was so much higher, minor children were buried, and then their mother and father joined them later. So every headstone inside Arlington tells a story, and those are the stories of heroes, but they're also the stories of great tragedy and suffering as well.
Well, less than 1% of Americans will have served in uniform at this current time in which we're living. Is that concerning to you, that the numbers are so small and that the connection to the U.S. military from civilians has really grown in distance, certainly from the time that, I mean, even time when I was a kid, I mean, Memorial Day parades in Glastonbury, Connecticut were, that was a really big deal. And I remember watching the World War I veterans marching and the World War II veterans and the Korean veterans. And it was a moment for all of us in our town to honor the military. And we still do honor the military, obviously, but somehow the connection seems much more distant, maybe because my father, who was in World War II, he's gone. The World War generation, II generation, is mostly passed away, dwindling in numbers, obviously, given the age. But I worry about that, that there's just not – it's not being taught in schools, really, and it's not really being taught in universities, except, you know, a lot of the negative stuff, or it's kind of a Wikipedia understanding of what our servicemen and women have done for us through the ages.
Yeah, Bill. Laura, I'm doing my small part. Every time I speak to a group of high schoolers or a group of college students and they ask me for advice about life, I say the first thing you should do is join the Army. So now, any of the services are great. Of course, I'm partial towards the Army, but there's no place where an 18-year-old or 22-year-old is going to learn more about himself and herself, learn responsibility and discipline, teamwork, focus, and leadership. I know that people at that age think they may fall behind their peers going to college or getting out and getting a fancy job. But trust me, when you're done with 3 or 4 years in the military, employers will look at you in a different way and your fellow citizens will look at you in a different way. Now, to your broader point, you're right that very few Americans today serve. And when you look at a family basis, it's even smaller because of that 1%. Many of them are siblings or sons or daughters of service members. One thing I learned in the research for Sacred Duty, though, is that is not all that uncommon historically. It really wasn't until the post-World War II period leading into the Cold War that we maintained a large standing army. That's one reason why the old guard, as I say in Sacred Duty, yeah, is literally the old guard. It goes back to 1784, one of the few federal regiments that existed since our nation's founding. It was really only from the early 1940s until the mid-1970s that we had mass conscription and a draft where everyone served. So we're back historically to where we were. We still have larger numbers of troops under arms, but it's still an all-volunteer military, yet also I think the prestige and honor that we have for our young men and women in uniform today is probably as high as it's ever been. And as I say in Sacred Duty, there's no place that you can see that more clearly than when you go to Arlington and you see the respect and the reverence and even the love that our fellow Americans show for the young soldiers who are there and for those who went before them who are resting there.
Well, it's kind of our... In a way, I would say the last heroes in American society that with all the rancor and politics and the culture and all the changes to the traditional family and some self-imposed, some imposed in other ways and changing mores and just challenges to the old military understanding. I think still to this day, men and women in uniform, they do elicit a respect that we don't have for many institutions left. I mean, we're tearing down statues. We're wanting to rename monuments, even named after our presidents. And I don't know. I'm fearful of that aspect of the desire to tear down history. And I hope the U.S. military never becomes falls victim to that.
I think one thing, as I said, while I was researching Sacred Duty, is I saw, the shifts in public opinion towards support for a larger military versus smaller military. It's very common after major wars, going back to the Revolutionary War, that our military rapidly shrinks, usually by too much. But one consistent theme I've seen over the last 40 years in that research is growing support for our military, even at times when wars became unpopular. It was striking to me to look as a soldier myself in the middle part of the last decade, you know, when you saw the unpopularity of the war in Iraq, yet you didn't see the kind of repudiation of the young men and women who were fighting that war that we saw in the late 1960s and early 1970s for so many of our Vietnam veterans. And no matter our divisions, no matter our differences in politics today, I think that speaks well of our fellow citizens, that they have that respect and reverence for the young men and women who carry the burdens of keeping this country free and safe.
Senator Cotton, lots of other news, of course, we have to hit with you. What's happening at our border? I was down there about 4 weeks ago in Del Rio, Texas, and had a chance to interview a bunch of the migrants who we picked up with the Border Patrol boats. And all of them came with nothing except a piece of paper with their family member or friend or another illegal immigrant who had helped send money down to get them up there. And it was a shock to see it. I mean, Border Patrol stations were holding hundreds of people meant for 20. There was no space. They're overwhelmed. They have no beds to put people. The system of catch and release because of asylum policies. What is going to be done here in Congress, if anything?
Well, it's a complete crisis. I don't think a lot of Americans who haven't been to the border realize how much things have changed just in the last year, because you have so many of these drug cartels that are profiting off trafficking people from Central America. Frankly, a lot of left-wing activist lawyers in America who are advocating for this as well. People are showing up on our border and no longer running away from the Border Patrol. They're running to the Border Patrol.
No, they ran to us. Yeah,
exactly. Because they know that they can game our system and make bogus claims of asylum and most likely get released into the country under their own recognizance. That's why so many Americans who do understand the situation are increasingly calling it a crisis. The president should pull out all the stops he has with every power he has under law and under the Constitution to secure our border. Because right now we are just being overwhelmed. But in some cases, as many as 3,000 or 4,000 illegal migrants every single day. And I think in the Congress, rather than trying to address longer-term immigration problems, which are very important, and I've got legislation to change some of those long-term problems, we need to deal with the crisis at hand. There are some very simple and targeted fixes that would tighten up our asylum laws to make sure that people can't show up at our borders and make a fraudulent claim of asylum just because they want to come to this country and live a better life and make more money. Look, I understand why they would do that. I don't understand why we would allow that. And if that's the standard for asylum, we'll have to grant asylum to 6.5 billion people around the world.
Right. Well, it's interesting when you talk to people, and they were mostly men, but most of them had children or people who they said were their children. A lot of them aren't their children. And they basically all just said, we're coming here to work. I mean, they all just said, we're coming here to work. And I mean, I don't know if they hadn't remembered the script they were given to say, or they didn't. I wasn't a Border Patrol official, but they all knew where they were going. They're going to Maryland, Texas, they're going to Houston, L.A., Boston, Northern Virginia, of course, Maryland, of course. But they know exactly where they were going. I mean, it was really disturbing on so many levels because we are funding the cartels by allowing our policy to continue. We're giving money to the cartels.
It's a complete farce, Laura. They probably were candid with you because you weren't wearing a Border Patrol uniform with an American flag on it. But as soon as they see one of those officers, and they immediately say, "I've got a credible fear of persecution," and they've been coached by a lot of these left wing activists on what to say exactly that. But the truth is, what they told you, they are showing up with kids on the border because the word is out in Central America. If you show up with a kid, you almost certainly will get released in the country. And then they're going to go stay with their family and friends in Arkansas or Baltimore or Boston or Chicago or where have you, and just start working and never show up again. It's a crazy system, and it's one that we can't allow to continue.
We're talking to Senator Tom Cotton, whose fabulous new book, Sacred Duty, just out a couple weeks ago, and it's fantastic. Senator Cotton, before we let you go, the disturbing developments to circumscribe speech in big social media companies, which conservatives have been talking about for some time. I just like your thoughts on that. I'm not saying there's any governmental fix here, but You see this as we get closer and closer to the real, you know, heating up of the 2020 campaign, with quote hate being described as people who like believe in border enforcement in some cases. There are, you know, true hateful, racist, awful people. But then there are people who just believe the border should be enforced and concern, of course, that they're getting whipped up into these censorious acts on the part of Facebook, et cetera.
Yeah, it's very worrisome, Laura, that all these big tech companies that control so much of the platforms for public debate now are apparently full of liberals at the highest reaches and are willing to relabel just, you know, normal, ordinary beliefs of mainstream Americans as hate speech to be censored without even telling them that. I think it's very important that, you know, people in elected office like me or public figures like you call that kind of behavior out whenever we see it. You know, you said there may not be a legal response to it, but there may be a legal response to it as well. The law evolves and times change as our ways change. And these companies should feel that they're immune from any kind of legislation or other administrative action under current laws if they're going to hold themselves out as these open public platforms with publicly disclosed terms of service, but then begin to discriminate against the viewpoints of pretty ordinary, mainstream, normal Americans.
Well, it seems like there's all the efforts are underway to, well, if you can't argue the economy, assuming the economy still is in pretty good shape in 2020, then you have to just circumscribe speech, you have to deplatform people, and you have to maybe change the Electoral College, which is the other effort. That's actually a very serious effort. They have a lot of states signed on to this idea that the electors don't have to actually vote for the winner in the state in which they are electors. I know as a lawyer and as a constitutional thinker such as you are, you must have thoughts on the Electoral College abolishment movement, which is picking up some steam.
Well, so much of what the left in America today is doing is rather than trying to change their message, change their appeal to voters since they lost the last election, is change the rules of voting. They want to end the Electoral College through what is probably an unconstitutional voter state compact, because Congress has not and I'm sure will not bless that compact. They want to pack the Supreme Courts. They want to turn Washington, D.C. into a state so they can have two permanent Democratic senators. Rather than trying to upend all these longstanding institutions that our democracy has, maybe they could just change their pitch so they can get a few more people in Wisconsin to vote for them.
Tom Cotton, the book Sacred Duty, A Soldier's Tour at Arlington National Cemetery. It's beautifully written, and just a reminder once again of how important service to one's country is. And if you have a chance to serve your country, you'll never regret it, as Senator Cotton said. And we realize how hot those uniforms are when we really when we read this book and the sweat that I saw pouring down the faces of these poor soldiers at Arlington. Oh, my gosh. A number of them passed out, by the way, Senator Cotton. I forgot to tell you that. And they tried. And isn't it a rule that the other ones can't help them up or something when they're...
So it is pretty hot in those heavy wool uniforms in the summer, as I say, in Sacred Duty. But if, yeah, the soldier to your right or left should happen to fall out of formation, then no, you don't break ceremonial composure. There are other soldiers who are usually nearby, hiding behind a tree or a bush, who are ready to step in and take their place.
Yeah, I saw that. And I was like, oh, my gosh, someone give him some water. But there were two or three of them that just completely passed out. God bless them. Anyway, thank you, Senator Cotton. We really appreciate it. Congrats on the book.
Thank you, Laura.
I hope you're enjoying this. Oh, the Laura Ingraham Podcast. This is the best of. And thank you for listening. We love your feedback. Always love your opinions. Want to hear from you. So you can email the show at ingram.podcast@gmail.com. That's ingram.podcast@gmail.com. Email me with your thoughts, or if you want to get on the show, just email me the topic you want to talk about or react to the topic we're tweeting or Facebooking out. Ingram.podcast@gmail.com. Keep the comments coming.